tonight on Arena. Stereophonics, Self Esteem and Willie Nelson have new albums, and Penelope, Etoile and Andor Season 2 are our TV reviews. You can text us on 51551 or on X at RT Arena or watch live on rt.ie/arena. Now on tonight's TV reviews, first up, Etoile is a new comedy drama on Prime Video that follows two fictional ballet companies in New York and Paris that are facing declining audiences and financial struggles. The directors decide to take a gamble to save their historic institutions by swapping their most talented dancers to boost business. The cast includes Luke Kirby, Charlotte Gainsbourg and Simon Callow. And over on Disney Plus, we have season two of Andor, the Star Wars spin-off. The first series ended with an uprising on planet Ferrix, and this one picks up the story a year later. Cassian Andor, played by Diego Luna, dives deep into the Rebel Alliance, and over a period of 4 years, we follow his transformation from a reluctant spy to the fearless hero of Rogue One. And finally, we have the coming-of-age drama Penelope on Sky. It stars Megan Stott as Penelope, a 16-year-old girl who finds herself questioning her place in the world and decides to run away on a soul-searching mission to the remote wilderness of the Pacific Northwest. Along the way, she meets a series of intriguing characters and falls in love for the first time. Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser join me in studio. They've been watching all three. Chris, we'll start with Etoile. It's a series set in the world of the classical arts, two ballet companies, one in Paris and the other in New York. But they both are in trouble.
They are both in trouble because the artistic director is played by Charlotte Gainsbourg in the Parisian Paris house, and then Luke Kirby playing Jack McMillan, who runs the New York side of things. They meet to discuss the fact that ever since COVID, things haven't been the same. Audiences, obviously, you know, the theatres were shut, audiences went away. A lot of them didn't come back. They're also concerned about people's attention spans, about the fact that, you know, is ballet this elitist performance dance, and how do we make it, you know, not that? So they come up with this bright idea, and I'd like to know if this has ever actually been done before, where they will swap their talent to try and boost revenue and to try and rescue their institutions.
Okay, let's go into that conversation where Genevieve, played by Charlotte Gainsbourg, and her team from Le Ballet National de Paris call a meeting with Jack, the executive director of the Met Ballet Theatre in New York, played by Luke Kirby, to discuss their declining business.
You're in trouble.
What?
Your company, it's in trouble.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
Mine is too. The audience is dead and dying, so's the funding. I've got union issues.
You're French.
Then there was the mighty reign of King COVID.
I've got long COVID.
Our dancers sat idle for months, losing muscle mass and fucking and eating.
And eating.
And eating.
Some quit. Four of mine did. How many for you?
Six.
There are some on sabbatical.
Sabbatical? Come on, Jack.
Where's Lauren Straw? She wasn't on stage last night.
She makes plant-based donuts in Memphis.
They're terrible, by the way. You need lard. You just need lard. There's no way around it.
Plant-based donuts? Face the facts, Jack. A lot of our dancers have abandoned toe shoes for TikTok. The dressing rooms are filled with screaming babies and asshole rescue dogs. A generation of young people was lost. The pipeline is ruined. The seats are empty.
Not ours.
No, that's right. Once we closed off the balconies, the house filled right up.
We have to fix this. Our jobs are on the line. Yours, mine, every person in here. Their heads are on the chopping block.
Okay, fine. Big talk. What do we do?
I propose a swap. We trade our top talent. Yours for ours.
Wait a minute.
I'm cautiously intrigued.
So Charlotte Gainsbourg there as Genevieve from the Paris Dance Company and Luke Kirby from the Met Ballet Theatre in New York. Now, Jen, the series was created by an ex-ballerina, but a rather accomplished show creator as well, Amy Sherman-Palladino, who created Gilmore Girls and The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. So this is her second attempt to make a ballet show.
It is, because if you are a Gilmore Girls fanatic like I am, hands up, you would know that...
Chris, put your hand up.
Oh, absolutely. I loved it.
When she left the show, she actually walked away from her own show by season 7, the final season, that she went off to create this Labour of Love called Bunheads, which was kind of her version of Fame. It was all about kind of lifting the lid on the world of dance and ballet, especially because that's where her heart is.
Fictional
ballet and fictional company. And it was about the strifes that they go through and how punishing it is on these young girls. And this is her second attempt at trying to get that. Now, after the success, the runaway success of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, as we know, it was about this Jewish 1950s housewife who ends up becoming this stand-up comedian, and it has, you know, the real Lenny, the character is Lenny Bruce, is there the real comedian Lenny Bruce, and that is played by Luke Kirby, who now has this main role as Jack in this series. And you can see that she wants to use the heft that she has with Prime Video to actually see this vision through about wanting to talk about what dance is and how much it means to her and the passion that she has for it. But this is all, there's so much of Amy Sherman-Palladino in this, all her usual quirks and kinks and everything that she is interested in. So as you could hear from that clip, she hates Gen Z, she hates millennials, she hates cancel culture, she thinks all of this is a wash. It's a, you know, you should be able to say whatever you like and through art, and she finds that very ridiculous. She loves Paris, she loves the golden age of Hollywood, especially those kind of comedies where it's the rat-a-tat-tat dialogue. People would know that from Gilmore Girls especially. And so the screwball comedy is still a major part of this and a major part of the dialogue. And it's either you get involved with that or you don't. I could tell from the opening scene where we see Jack and Genevieve together in this nightclub and they're arguing about whether or not certain the composers, whether they had STDs or not, you knew it was, you're right back into this world. And you either find that charming, these kind of circular arguments that these people have where they're very repetitive, you either find that charming or you find it really irritating, and you're either going to get into that or you're not. And that's, this show is powered on Sherman Palladino's whimsy. She is a whimsical woman, and she loves that, creating these kind of worlds.
I get the circular jokes you're talking about, but the humour is mainly founded, isn't it, Chris, on the cultural clash between them?
It is a little bit. And I'm actually usually a fan of that circular arguments that the Palladinos do so well. But at times I found this was almost like a show that was trying to be like a Palladino classic. Whereas like in Gilmore Girls and The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, those rat-a-tat arguments that Jenna's talking about, they are charming because they're being delivered by charming characters. But here they're being delivered by characters who are occasionally very difficult to like. Like Luke Kirby's Jack McMillan, for instance, he's the man in charge of the theatre in New York, and he believes that it's his theatre. It's the Fish family theatre. You know, his family built it like 70 or 100 years before that, and he believes, you know, it's his rightful place to be at the top of it. And he is quite arrogant. He knows that they're in a bit of a mess, but it's his arrogance and it's his ego that makes him impossible to like. And Charlotte Gainsbourg, who usually I do quite like, I found her character here quite annoying. In fact, I found an awful lot of characters here quite annoying, and I
liked how annoying they were. Like Shianne, who is like the star of the French side,
couldn't
of
get
things
on board with her.
She is like the literal, if you boil her down, she is exactly the kind of character that Sherman Palladino creates in these worlds. Like, she's hot-headed, she's, you know, with perfect hair, she's like this deep love of art, like she is this zenith of the Palladino kind of woman, and crossed with this kind of cool French girl tick, like a box ticking kind of exercise. So I mean, she's all into like environmental issues as well as into dance, and it is so preposterous, but there's something kind of charming about it.
I feel like the Cheyenne stuff, although the series revolves around her.
Cheyenne then is the wonderful dancer who is coming from France to America.
Yeah, she is the étoile. She is the star dancer. When Jack and Charlotte Gainsbourg character, when they meet to discuss who they're going to swap, for instance, the New York theatre is going to get Cheyenne from Paris. That wasn't supposed to be part of the deal because she's the main draw there. And then the French theatre gets Tobias Bell, played by Glennon Click, I think his name is. He is quite an eccentric choreographer, let's say, who likes things done a certain way. Cheyenne coming to New York is not something that she wanted to do. So we get this whole introduction where Cheyenne is involved as an environmentalist on this fishing boat, which is protesting a ship run by the billionaire arms manufacturer that's actually going to invest the opera. If that sounds very busy, it's because it is. So all of that stuff I found as though like we were getting to know the different companies, and then we interrupt the show to bring you Cheyenne's story. It felt as though it was just being dragged in from a different type of cartoon or show.
Yes, I was rather disappointed as well, because Cheyenne does a wonderful dance in the first episode. Yes. And I thought it was so short. Could have been much longer.
There are more dances as it goes on, and there are more choreography sequences that are actually really great. And I do think also there's a really different kind of tact it takes at the end, like where there's these end credits come up, and it's usually to a song that Amy Sherman-Palladino loves, like a Brian Eno song. Yeah. Sparks are always in her work, and I love that about her. But it shows the dancers in this kind of removed, almost impressionistic way. It's very Sofia Coppola, I think, and it feels like a different show. And I really found that the ending, I wanted to watch the end credits all the time, because you're seeing the dancers kind of relaxing or rehearsing or warming up to do a dance or then performing a dance. And I think that was very beautiful. But I have to say, like, I really enjoyed Charlotte Gainsbourg's character. And I know, you know, it has all that the cultural references that they always bring to the shows, where it reminds you of the days of Gawker or Perez Hilton, where there's those kind of references, pop culture references. But I'd rather her like talking about the Olsen twins than actually, you know, seeing her being tortured in a Lars von Trier film. I found this like a nice different side to her, different quality to her.
We're not in a Lars von Trier
film. We're definitely not. And I loved her relationship with her sister. The two of them are, you know, fiery. They fight against each other constantly. And there's something, she adds this kind of quality to the show. It's not cartoonish, it's not over the top. She's almost dialing it down against Kirby, like against Jack Kirby, and I found that enjoyable to watch. I think he is smouldering.
But it was too busy for you, Chris.
Oh, absolutely. Brooding. I mean, there's one character you could remove completely and I wouldn't be upset about it, and that's Simon Callows. He's the billionaire arms manufacturer who wants to be the financier here. And Jack,
I love Simon Callows, but
he's brilliant, but
what's he doing here?
Oh, he hasn't got a mustache here, but if he had one, he'd be twirling it. He is just an unnecessary villain in a show that's already full of bad guys. We just don't need him. I found that storyline a little bit ridiculous.
But David Haig is great from The Thick of It.
He's good.
He is really good.
Yeah, no, he fits into
part of the company in New York, like he's part of the board. And I think he's brilliant. I think he's really funny. And then for Gilmore Girl fans, Yannick Truesdale is back. So he was Michelle in Gilmore Girls. He was the very kind of uptight concierge that would work with Lorelai.
What's he in this?
So he is also a sarcastic French person, but now he's a French ballet administrator instead. It's literally just like they took the character of Michelle and kind of put him in this other role. But then you also have a little pop in from Headmaster Charleston as well, which I don't know what that actor's name is. But Gilmore Girl fans will enjoy this. And I found it just to be such a luxurious watch. I found it to be something, it's nice and escapist and it looks beautiful and it's fun. And I think Luke Kirby is, I think there will be a lot of fan fiction written about him after this.
Okay, stars out of 5 from you, Jen, if he can be contained in 5.
I just think it's very charming, but I do understand why people won't like it. So I will hold myself back and contain myself and give it a good... I want to say 4. I do want to say 4 because I know I'm going to lap this up. I'm going to watch this when I go
Chris.
Home.
A lot of talented people involved, but I felt as though it was just 3, 4, maybe even 5 different ideas and shows kicking against one another. So I'm going to have to go with 2.5. I'm afraid.
Okay, 2.5 and 4 for Etoile. And now we leave the classical arts behind and move to outer space with yet another series from the Star Wars franchise. This time Andor Series 2. So Jen, this is Season 2. But they are both, Season 1 and 2 are the prequel to the film, which is Rogue One. Yes.
Yeah.
So we don't have to go into the whole Star Wars history, but you can set it up where we find us post in this Season 2.
We can get too bogged down, I think, in lore sometimes. So the 12 episode second season of this, of Andor, it's split it across into 4 chapters. So they're kind of 3 episode blocks, if you will. So, and each block is by a different director and a different kind of writing team as well. So what you're doing is each of these, it takes place in a different year, beginning in BBY4, which is 4 years prior to A New Hope, which is the Star Wars film that we all know. So each chapter kind of Andor draws us closer and closer to what happened in Rogue One. So Rogue One told the story of the rebel spies who stole the crucial plans to build the Death Star, the moon-sized space station that basically destroys planets. And at the end of Andor's, you know, that story in Rogue One, it ends tragically. So we know this is building up to a tragedy. And I think why Andor has succeeded when a lot of Star Wars spin-offs kind of fail is it's the writing and it's the involvement of Tony Gilroy. And he wrote, you know, Rogue One, but he's also responsible for The Bourne Supremacy and the very, very brilliant Michael Clayton. And I think that heft and that seriousness and this desire to excavate the truth and uncover the darkness within the Star Wars franchise, within that Star Wars universe that we all know is there. We all love The Empire Strikes Back for a reason, because of this darkness. And he wants to really get under our skin. And he's treating this world extremely seriously. And for him, he can, you know, dig into the feelings about the current state of the world. So it's showing you it's not a galaxy far, far away. It's actually a galaxy that's just, it's actually just right outside your doorstep. All these things are happening. And I think that's what makes Andor quite
yes,
different.
Chris, because he spoke to our colleague Sinead Egan, and he was they were talking about, you know, the research they did into all kinds of rebellion, all kinds of propaganda, and that is all plowed into this series.
Yeah, I mean, that's how Star Wars started off in the first place. It was reflecting, you know, it was this highfalutin space opera, but at the same time, it was reflecting, you know, a very near history, the World War at the time. So Tony Gilroy kind of saying, okay, so what is this good and evil thing about? It doesn't have to, we don't need lightsabers, we don't need Jar Jar, we don't need any talk of the Force here. Let's do something a little dirtier, a little grittier, a little more grounded. And I found this series, the first season and shades of the second one too, to be more kind of John le Carré than George Lucas, and I think that's a good thing. And the other thing that sticks out for me is that the universe that Tony Gilroy has built, a little bit like you know, what we see in the Bourne films, it feels lived in. It feels as though, you know, like some of the homes that the people live in, the spaceships that they have, the droids that are going around, they're beat up, they're dusty, they're broken. Everything looks as though it's about to fall apart. That was part of the appeal of the first couple of Star Wars films. And this is going to sound so simple, but I love the fact that a lot of Andor is shot outdoors. You know, it's shot on location in these beautiful parts of the world, and that might sound so silly, but we've just become too used to seeing these things shot on sound stages against green screens, and it just removes part of the magic for the viewer. Whereas when you're watching Andor, you feel you can reach out and touch this thing, and that makes a huge difference for me.
Now, let's listen to a clip. There's one sinister scene where the galaxy, the Empire people get together and they have a sinister plot. And they're going to do all kinds of digging in the planet. You maybe set it up, will you, for us, Chris?
Yeah.
This is where they're meeting to plan what they're going to do in Gorman.
The Gorman massacre. Yeah,
I think any Star
it's
Wars like, fan knows that the Gorman massacre is this like touchstone. It's a point of when it's like the rebellion. That's when they want to get together. After this Gorman massacre, so you're kind of aware of it as a Star Wars person. But if you're not,
no, you have Ben Mendelsohn's character, who is obviously playing a bad guy. Ben Mendelsohn has rarely played a good guy. They are discussing plans to mine this rare mineral, but they're, you know, the Imperial warriors are not going to go in there and just take this, and the, you know, population is going to be okay. It's going to end very badly for the people who live there.
Okay, so we'll hear Ben Mikkelsen now reprieve his role in Rogue One of Orson Kerenick in Andor.
No notes. No records. None of you were here. Nobody puts this in their calendar. All service and transport droids will be data wiped once we're done. Your colleagues, superiors, if they're not in this room, they're not cleared for the project. Colonel Yularen, Governor Tarkin, all senior commanders will be notified by the Emperor at the time of his choosing. Now, the group in this room is of this moment the tightest of closed circles. Any security violation will be brought to the Emperor's personal attention.
Now, Ben Mendelsohn there. And that's quite a chilling scene, isn't it? Because they have plans for this Gorman, this planet, and they've decided to really dig it up to see what jewels they can find beneath in terms of
they're fracking it to death, basically.
Yes.
And they don't care about the citizens. And there is almost like this propaganda video that is shown where you kind of, it feels like you're looking at something from a newsreel, like the you know, from Nazi Germany in that way, and comparing the civilians to rats. And, you know, they know that this is going to be a massacre. And the rising star of, you know, this whole situation is Deirdre Miro, who's Denise Goff again. We'll talk about her again. She's marvellous. And she has to decide whether she's going to be the face of this project. And, you know, the death toll is going to be massive, and it will serve her career ambitions, obviously. But, and you're very aware of that. And you're very aware that, you know, she may be conflicted about this, about what she exactly wants to do and how this will have a massive effect on
yes.
everything.
Mm. But of course, there is the Rebel Alliance, and they are, we find them, they're pretty scattered, aren't they, Chris?
They are, yeah. Yeah, and poor Cassian gets a little bit lost in the galaxy
the Diego
as well.
Luna
this
character.
Diego Luna, yeah. When we first meet him, he is once again pretending to be somebody he's not. He's actually posing as an Imperial fighter. He is going to basically steal a prototype TIE fighter to bring it back to, you know, his rebels and show him what the Empire has been working on. That doesn't really happen to him, because once he gets to his destination, which is a planet, a jungle planet basically, he finds this ragtag band of warriors who think that because of the uniform he's wearing, he must be one of the bad guys, and he gets caught up in their own squabbling. So he spends like a lot of the first couple of episodes of season two handcuffed and trying to survive this war between the warriors. So all that stuff is quite slow. The first three episodes are quite slow. There's a lot of exposition. A lot of catch up, but also at the same time, it's been 2.5 years since Andor season one, so I actually found that necessary and quite enjoyable. It doesn't all have to be, again, lasers and lightsabers and guns and fights in space. Like, I like the build up, and you can tell, we were only talking about this beforehand, you can tell it is going to go somewhere special. And I think what stands out for me, what makes Andor actually special for me, is that we know where this is headed. We know that it ends badly for everybody, and that's not a spoiler to say that. But Tony Gilroy has done such a fantastic job in actually ensuring that, despite the fact that we know where it's going, it's still compelling and it's still suspenseful and it's still miles ahead of any other Star Wars show.
Okay, stars out of five from you, Chris, for
Andor. I think actually it deserves 5 stars for getting an anonymous Irish warrior to say "get stuffed" to one of the characters. That caught me by surprise, and I love that. At the minute, it's about 3.5 stars out of five, but I know it's going to improve.
Okay, and from you, Jen.
That's it. It is a 4. Like, in the words of like Malcolm Tucker, there's a lot of Shawshank before your redemption. So you have to wade through a lot of exposition to get to it. But like, persevere with these three, after these three, and you know the vision is going to pay off, because as Chris said, you know it's going to end up really bad. And I think the real life template, the real life influences that are sown in throughout the show are hard to escape. And it's hard to kind of work your way around that. Like, it is an achievement in itself in that way, because I think taking on, confronting the horrors of the world, of this modern world, in this franchise that is far reaching, is a very big thing to do on Tony Gilroy's part, and he has to be commended.
Well, 3.5 and 4 stars for Andor season 2. And finally, we come to Penelope on Now TV and a young girl's journey of self-discovery. Chris, tell us, what was the catalyst that caused this young girl to go on the run?
Well, we don't actually know yet. When we first meet Penelope, because this is a show that doesn't rely on a lot of dialogue to tell its story, when we first meet her, she's actually at a silent disco, which is indicative of everything that we're going to see. And at this silent disco, she sees this wolf in the distance, you know, all of these teenagers around her. She's at some sort of summer camp retreat. Maybe her family are there. She sees this wolf, and it's almost as though she's envious of the wolf being able to escape into the woods. So bright and early the next morning, Penelope, played by Megan Stott, who is a relative newcomer on her screens, she leaves to go on this solo hiking expedition. And she texts her mom, who wants her back, who says that she has to go home, prepare for her SAT. She says that she'll be back, but she has different plans. She finds the nearest camping store. She is lucky to have a $500 voucher in order to get a tent, some supplies, a bag, snacks, all the rest of it. Hops on the nearest train, you know, illegally hops on the back of this train and just sets off on the hike. And we don't know, we get the feeling that she's questioning everything. Who am I? Who do I want to be? What do I want to do with my life? What does it all mean? Questions you never stop asking. But there's no real kind of sense yet that she might have been in some sort of trouble, that maybe she has a bad relationship with her parents. Her parents are clearly worried about her. They've been texting her, but she turns off her phone. She just wants to, maybe before she goes out into the world, just to kind of connect with nature herself and see what it's all about.
Yes, and does she get into lots of dangerous scrapes? I've seen one episode and there was no scrape.
I think for me, the show
she met a man and he was nice to her.
Thank God. And I'm actually so glad when you meet like his character. I mean, he's kind of like this troubadour in like a cafe. So it's Austin Abrams. And you are worried. You're like, this is a 16-year-old girl on her own. My God, how badly could it be? And you have all those fears. And I think it's great that it doesn't do that. It doesn't have those fears. It's not about, this is not a true crime show. This is not a thriller, a detective thriller. This is actually something else. And I think it's heavily indebted to the work of the filmmaker Kelly Reichardt, who did this indie film, Wendy and Lucy, with Michelle Williams, which was about her, drifting across America with her dog. But now she was in poverty. And I do feel like there's something with this show that kind of irked me about the fact that this is a very privileged kid that is ostensibly has no problems and is just disappearing into the wilderness. And isn't it a lark? But I also think there's something underneath this about it's by the Duplass brothers. So it's Mark Duplass, who is the showrunner, and he has, you know, teenage daughters of his own, and I think he's speaking to his daughters through this. And the idea of Penelope at 16 years old, she's making her way out into the wild unprotected, making mistakes, and is at the mercy of the world. And it's his kind of metaphor for trying to let go as a parent and see his young girls, you know, as budding grown-ups. Like, so the dangers will always be out there and you can't protect your children from that. And it's very impressionistic, like not a lot of dialogue, as we're saying, a lot of silences, a lot of beautiful cinematography, but it's about her adapting to the dangers around her. And I am so glad that it's kind of like a fantasy, because the true crime is very punishing, I think, on young girls, and violent thrillers, and they're everywhere. And I think it's so nice to have a young girl have her boy's own adventure story. And isn't it nice just to leave it at that and not have maybe the reality encroach on this lovely world about her experience in nature and her connecting with the outdoors?
That would seem to put a lot of pressure on this newcomer actress, Chris.
You think that, yeah, but she is terrific. Like her presence here, it's a beautiful performance. It's a beautiful looking show as well, because, I mean, Penelope is spending a lot of time, you know, in the great outdoors, and I think Mark Duplass and Mel Elson, they shoot it beautifully. I like, not a lot happens in a cave, but at the same, I mean, the second episode, for instance, revolves around Penelope sourcing water and spending her first night camping and building a fire for the first time. And then in the third, she befriends a baby bear. And that's sort of the crux. I mean, these episodes are only about half an hour long. So it's like one little storyline is all it needs and the rest is silence. So maybe some patience is required, but it does have this wonderful storybook-like charm to it. I bought into the fantasy. Yes, as Jen was saying, there was a part of me kind of thinking, well, aren't you lucky to have that $500 in your back pocket? And what are your parents going to say? What are they actually thinking now that their teenage daughter has gone missing in the Pacific Northwest? But that doesn't matter, because I think it does set itself up as a fantasy. It's so brilliantly performed by Megan Stout. There is some nice support there. I actually thought Austin Abrams is quite nice, it is a nice performance of Sam, because again, when I saw him and when I saw them connect, I was worried. But it doesn't go to a dark place. Instead, it's just about this teenager discovering the world for the first time and also discovering the kindness of strangers, and we kind of need that.
Okay, well, that sounds good. Stars from you, Chris?
We'll go with 3.5 out of 5. Give it a chance.
3.5. And from you?
So I went ahead and kind of watched a little bit more, and she does, it's Penelope for a reason. I think it's like her own odyssey, and she does meet an older kind of environmentalist in one episode. So there's somebody teaching her lessons, I think, all the time. So it's about survival, and it is kind of like, you know, a bit fanciful, because you're like, we're living in a world where a lot of teenage girls are homeless, like for real. So it's a bit ignorant like that, but I do think it's about it's an adventurous fantasy story about resilience, and I found it really admirable and beautiful to watch. So I think I'll give it 3.5 as well.
3.5 for Penelope. Etoile is streaming on Prime Video. Andor is on Disney Plus, and Penelope is available on Sky and Now TV. Jen Cannon and Chris Wasser, thank you so much. Now it's time for album reviews with Zara Hederman and Kian Sullivan. They've been listening to the latest albums from Wales's finest Stereophonics as they ask us to make them laugh, make them cry, make them wait. Self-Esteem, or Rebecca Lucy Taylor, follows up the hugely successful Prioritise Pleasure with A Complicated Woman. And Willie Nelson is back with his take on another great American songwriter, this time Rodney Crowell, in O Beautiful World. So let's start with Stereophonics, and this is There's Always Gonna Be Something.
So what's it gonna be today? Bayonet tongue in silence, whispering just to remind us. Imposter cries, be there a thief. Stop stealing pain for yourself.
That's There's Always Gonna Be Something from Make 'Em Laugh, Make 'Em Cry, Make 'Em Wait from Stereophonics. And as I say, Keen Sullivan and Zara Heatherman are here and they've been listening to all the albums. What does the title mean, Keen?
It's a expression that Kay Jones had learned from his art teacher, I think, when he was a teenager. And it was more about the art of performance. And he thinks that making them laugh, making them cry, making them wait is all part of a good on stage performance. And he kind of thinks that over the years he's kind of been doing this without really knowing it, and he's recently sort of reflected on the term, and he thinks, yeah, by, you know, telling them an anecdote, connecting with them, telling them a joke, making them laugh and building some sort of anticipation is
yes, because Kelly Jones has been making them wait because he's gone off and done other things, hasn't he, and he's back now with Stereophonics, you know, after a creative break.
Yes, exactly. We were discussing it on the show, I think around last year, last May. He went off and did his own solo outing, a second of those called Inevitable Incredible. He took some time off, he went and spent some time on his own, some solitude off the coast of Norway, and he was really sort of digging deep into mental health. He was sort of meditating on his own mortality. He was aiming for this sort of cinematic piece with violins. I don't remember loving it at the time, but yes, now he's back with the band, and I think he's actually taken the use of violins from that time and brought it onto this album, which I think works well and adds quite like a hopeful note on this record.
Okay, we'll ask you if you're loving this in a minute, Kian. Sorry, you were a bit worried about this one. It's the 13th album and I think you're a fan, but you were a bit cautious approaching this.
I was apprehensive because as it's the 13th album, I hadn't really listened to them since maybe the Dakota era, and that's maybe about 15 or so years ago. So I worried how a band at this point, like they formed in 1992, what are they going to be saying? How are they also going to be sounding? Because Kelly Jones has always had that very gravelly voice and he's always kind of extended it very well. And I was really surprised at actually how pretty his voice sounds. It still has that graspiness, but I think that age kind of really suits this album. And as Keane said, like there's a really nice employment of strings on this. Like it's a bit more of a grander, a very pleasant rock album, but then also like incorporating things like brighter, like folk rock things. He has a bit more harmonica on here. And yeah, like it's 8 songs long as well. And I think that was something that he was talking about as well recently, of kind of wanting to be a bit more concise and not like overbloating an album. And interestingly, this album came because it was initially just going to be 2 songs he was writing for a compilation. And that's how the last Stereophonics album came about as well, but he actually just had such a wealth of writing and demos that it turned into an 8 songs and 29 minutes, which is a nice kind of length to spend time with this album.
Okay, let's listen to another track. This is Seems Like You Don't Know Me. Seems Like You Don't Know Me there from Make 'Em Laugh, Make 'Em Cry, Make 'Em Wait from Stereophonics. So Kian, that's one of the tracks you picked out, but it's also one of the singles. I think you thought the singles were the strongest.
Yeah, definitely. And that and the first track you played were definitely my 2 favourites from it. That one had quite nice sparse synths, as we heard there, like you're propelled along with that drum beat. But there's also a great use of space, and it's all about the space between a long-term couple who are kind of constantly changing and finding out new things about each other. So I thought it was interestingly used as well. And like the first track, There's Always Going to Be Something, while I liked it, I think they slightly over-leaned on the use of repetition, I think, which kind of dragged them down a bit. I was kind of really rooting for them on like the third act to really hit it out of the park. And I think a higher high would have kind of really elevated this album for me a bit.
Right.
But I think it's pretty solid.
And you picked a few clangers as well.
I did, yes. Eyes Too Big for My Belly was a bit of a clanger for me. It was him kind of doing Alex Turner from the Arctic Monkeys. The line that kind of made me cringe every time I heard it was heading out of style like a pinstripe suit. I look a little taller in a Chelsea boot, which kind of, ooh, makes me kind of wince. But look, that's only 1 of 8.
Sarah, overall?
This was pleasant. They didn't really deliver anything very memorable on it, but it was a 3 out of 5 for me.
Okay, Finn, praise indeed. Go on, Key, and you. I love the way Sarah does it. She kills you with a smile.
I was in a similar ballpark. I think it's a really solid effort. I think if you're going to go see them in St. Anne's Park or Virgin Media Park, you're going to enjoy this, but I think you won't be disappointed. Only two of these songs appear on the set list. I think with a bigger hit, it would have been a four, but for me, it's a three.
Okay. Another smile there. Knife in the back. Okay. Next, Self Esteem returns with her third album, A Complicated Woman, highly anticipated after the huge hit of Prioritize Pleasure 4 years ago. So tell us about the success of Prioritize Pleasure, Zara, and where we are now.
Oh, it was astronomical. And that was her second album as Self Esteem. And it really made her a mainstream proposition. She then would go on to support Blur at Wembley. So really bringing her to huge audiences. So it was really, and at that point as well, it should be noted that that wasn't her first kind of foray into music. She had previously been in a band called Slow Club for a decade. They'd released 5 albums. So she was in a very interesting position with Prioritize Pleasure. And I think a lot of people were waiting for what the next statement was. And the 4 years in between, she has talked about how she was filled with actually quite a lot of self-doubt. And you can hear that, I think, in this album. And she also has talked about how with the success of that album, the record label gave her a much bigger budget, so she was able to incorporate a lot more orchestration into this, a lot more choir into this as well. And I think that those bigger kind of successful elements have actually been to the detriment of where she could have actually taken this next statement.
All right, well, let's listen to a track. This is called Mother from A Complicated Woman by Self Esteem. Mother there from A Complicated Woman by Self Esteem. And she's, of course, Rebecca Lucy Taylor. And Key and you have been doing a deep dive into research on the same Rebecca. And you've came up with interesting facts.
I'm not sure which interesting fact you're looking for.
Well,
me
you
to
said
go for.
You to all these things. You followed her on Instagram.
I do.
And you saw who she follows and you thought it said a lot about
I
her.
I do. Yeah, well, I think if you're new to Rebecca Lucy Taylor, I think a great place to start to see the 5 accounts that she follows on Instagram are George Michael, Jodie Comer, the actress, there's a filth drag queen called Meatball who appears on a track in the album, Madonna, and Kermit the Frog. And I think there's theatricality in there, there's superstardom, there's you know, not be willing to be the butt of a joke. There's so much in there, and I think that kind of makes up all the component parts of Self-Esteem.
Right. Now, you picked out that track, Mother. What are the things she writes about? I mean, they're varied, but they're very, I don't know, talking to millennials and people who are the same age as her.
Yeah, exactly. I think a lot of this comes from the track I Do This All The Time, which was on her previous album, Prioritize Pleasure, which I kind of describe as, do you remember that song about sunscreen that Baz Luhrmann made out of that commencement speech? It's kind of like a sunscreen for the millennial woman, I kind of find. And this album has, as Zara kind of alluded to, turned into this sort of millennial self-actualization gospel moment where almost every song is kind of dealing with another aspect of womanhood, which in itself is really important, but it's also good when she's having fun.
That's right. And she uses choirs, so
there's
that
a lot
idea
of choirs.
Of gospel
exactly.
is very pertinent.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But then on a track like Mother, she's having fun. There's another track called 69. We don't need to go into what that's about. I'm not even sure. Maybe it's the moon landing. But in those songs, she's just having fun because it's kind of electronic. She's kind of left the choir at home and she's just kind of dancing around having a good time.
Okay, let's listen to The Curse. That's The Curse from A Complicated Woman by Self Esteem. Now, Zara, you were saying there that you were kind of sorry about the way she had taken it. There's no point in thinking what way you'd like to have her to have taken it. But what is disappointing to you in this?
A number of things. So the reliance on the big orchestral songs like The Curse, it just felt a bit faceless to me. Also, I felt that like her sharpness and her lyricism on this album dwindled quite a lot. Like I felt on the previous album, she's razor sharp with her her words about just like the female experience of misogyny, of even just like women feeling kind of threatened in social situations. Like, that's not really here so much. Here, like, that song, The Curse, is about her relationship with alcohol. Earlier on, I Do and I Don't Care, you know, she's talking more so about like, if I feel so empowered, then why am I such a coward? It's just not really, it's too insular for me. I preferred it when her experience was more of a shared, or she articulated it in more of a universal way. And I wish there was more songs like Mother. Even there's a song with Moonchild Sonelli on this album, In Plain Sight, which is another kind of highlight, but she had a single with that artist last year, which is so much more interesting in terms of its production. And on their song on this one, Moonchild Sonelli is actually the leading light in that. And she says something very interesting, which is, what would be of me if I speak my mind, can I still exist? And I feel like that was kind of what we were getting from Rebecca Lucy Taylor in the previous album, where this is just a bit safe for me.
All right. Stars out of 5 from you, Key, and I think you liked it more than Zara.
I did. You know, while I did feel a bit of an orchestral overdose at times, I still think she's a really singular artist, and I can't really put anyone in as a comparison to her. I still really enjoy the highs on this, even if I will skip some of the orchestral moments. It's 4 out of 5.
4 out of 5. And from you, Zara?
This was a one where I'll pick and choose what songs I go back to, so it was a 3 from me.
Okay, we'll be back with one more after the break. You're listening to Friday Night's Arena, and we're at our album review. Zara Hederman and Cian Sullivan are here. Now it's time for Mr. Willie Nelson's 77th solo studio album, and he's 154th record overall. It's Oh, What a Beautiful World. Let's hear the opening track, What Kind of Love.
I'll show you the best I can show you, baby.
So that's What Kind of Love there you. From Oh, What a Beautiful World. And that was Willie Nelson, obviously. Zara, this is an album that it's part of an ongoing project he has, where he's done versions of favourite songwriters like Kris Kristofferson, Harlan Howard and Lefty Frizzell. And this one are the songs of Rodney Crowell. Tell us who he is.
Yeah, so he's a multi-Grammy winning artist who has released under his own name, but also has had a lot of success writing for the likes of Roseanne Cash, Amy Lou Harris, Keith Urban. And Willie Nelson has a long history with him. He recorded one of his songs back in 1983, and also on his previous album, The Border, last year, he recorded one of his songs. And Willie Nelson handpicked these 12 ones for this album to demonstrate, as he said, the need for human connection and appreciation of the beauty in each moment of life. And I thought that even though they're not songs written by Nelson, I feel like now that he's nearly 92 next week, there's a new kind of meaning that these words take on. Like, these songs span 50 years and they feel so prescient and they feel so relevant to Willie Nelson. Like, there's one where he says, the day I rest is the day I die. But there was one song actually that I just, every time I heard him say it, it really stood out to me. It's on The Flyboy and the Kid, where he says, may you always stay in touch with the things that keep you young. When you're staring at injustice, may you never bite your tongue. Which Willie Nelson, as well as being such a prolific songwriter and recording artist, he's also been such a hugely important advocate for whether it's farmers, rural communities, the LGBTQ community as well. So I just felt that this was such a special achievement that he's made. And it's just a really, like we heard there, the arrangement, really beautifully delivered too.
Yes, the arrangements would be with his Buddy Cannon is his long-term partner as producer. And he is on the controls in this as well. Did you like it, Cian?
I do struggle when it's all covers by a different person, and I appreciate that, you know, this is something he's been doing for a while, and you know you don't always have to write your own music either, but I do struggle when it's I'm kind of like, do you want to say this, especially how prolific he is as a writer? I'm like, is this really coming from the heart, or is this just another project, which I find kind of cynical about it. I think he sounds great. The best thing about this is I really loved his voice. I think it's both soft but gravelly. I think it's vulnerable but not frail. I think it's really like deft but also not overexerted. I think the way that they've produced this album sounds really nice. I think it's quite all from the same palette. I kind of got it maybe a bit harmonica'd out by the end of it. And when I went back to listen to some of the originals, like, I actually thought they fared better. I thought Keith Urban captured the melody of his, of Making Memories of Us, a bit better. I think Tim McGraw,
he would have recorded it previously.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, yeah. Yes, yeah. With Tim McGraw's original version and the Emmylou Harris version of Open Season My Heart, I thought was slightly better as well. So yeah, you're not making the songs better, I do struggle with finding why am I listening to this.
Okay, well, let's listen to another track. She's Back in Town.
Gift, she's one of those who comes and goes. She's back in town. Hey, when she's gone, I keep my head.
That's She's Back in Town from Oh, What a Beautiful World, sung there by Willie Nelson. I kind of get what you're both saying. I kind of get the fact that it's a project, what Kian is saying, that you think, oh yeah, he's just singing other people's songs. But it does really get you then, as Zara said, when you do hear a profound, or a line that comes across in a very profound way, because it's Willie Nelson, a 92-year-old man with such a career, singing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I actually thought that song, She's Back in Town, was one of the songs that jarred a little bit for me, because it is just a bit kind of like honky-tonk, like you'd hear it in a bar, maybe in Nashville, anyone could sing it. Mm-hmm. But in saying that, again, the instrumentation is really nice on it. And what I loved as well is that, like, he has a really loyal band with him. Like, on harmonica, he's got Mickey Raphael, who's been with him since 1973. On that song as well, there's double bass from Glenn Wharf, who's toured with, like, Mark Knopfler. So everyone is so accomplished on this, and you can kind of pick and choose, again, like the Self Esteem album, the moments you want to stick with on this.
So overall, Cian, for Willie Nelson.
Yeah, look, we're happy to have Willie Nelson. I'm glad he's having fun, but it's only 2.5 from me.
A 2.5 from you. And for you, Zara?
I really enjoyed my time with this, and I thought he sounded great, and the message of the songs were really nice. That was a 4 from me.
Yes, and I think you just said that there are other Willie Nelson albums.
There are.
Yes, and as Cian said, maybe that if you are listening to Willie Nelson, you'd like him to be singing his own songs. But, you know.
Yeah, it's a nice project.
Last Man Standing is one of his last great kind of all written himself that I'd recommend.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you for that. So that's Willie Nelson, Oh, What a Beautiful World, Self-Esteem, A Complicated Woman, or Stereophonics, Make 'em Laugh, Make 'em Cry, Make 'em Wait. And Zara Hederman and Cian Sullivan, thank you very much. That's it for tonight's show. Paula Shields was the researcher. Paul Murnock was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Sinead Egan. John Creedon is next after the news at 8.